Tzoraim Tovim. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to welcome you. To welcome Rabbi Alex Magid to give his inaugural shiur for Torah in Motion. Rabbi Magid is actually a graduate of CHAT, Community Hebrew Academy of Toronto, Tannenbaum CHAT, where I teach, and where he was a student not so many years ago. You see by his face, very few years ago. But since then, he has gotten smicha at Yeshiva University, has a law degree from Harvard, and will be giving today's shiur on legal and Jewish perspectives on what I would normally, I shouldn't say normally, in 1 in 100 years when Shabbos Chanukah isn't on Miketz, so this would be the Torah. But that's, I think it happened about 4 years ago, but it's extremely rare that Miketz is not Shabbos Chanukah. But as it is, it's a fascinating story. And Vakasha, Rabbi Magid.
Thank you. Bereshis Rabbi Kalman, and thank you everyone for joining us today. I'm really excited about this year, and I'm excited to learn together with you. So let's jump right in. I'll give you some background just sort of on how this developed. This year is really a product of two loves, and Rabbi Kalman alluded to my background a little bit. The number one love is the love of Tanakh. I grew up, I did Chidon HaTanakh as a kid at Associated, and then at CHAT, went to Israel, spent years and years memorizing biblical passages and common phrases. And then I went to yeshiva in Israel, and for the first time I realized that there's meaning to some of this memorization, that it's one thing to insert all these biblical phrases into the dark hole of your memory, and it's another thing to realize, hey, if the same phrase appears three times and only three times, maybe the Tanakh is telling us something unique through the way that it developed that phrase. And I started this site, What's Pshat, to develop the Divrei Torah around that theme, and I ended up studying this type of thing in grad school academically, and so I became very familiar with biblical texts and really loved them. And the second love that gets married to the first one in this year is the love that I got from law school, and really before that, Talmudic education, legal reasoning, all of that is part and parcel of what it means to be an observant Jew, and certainly with my background, it's important professionally as well. And in particular, there's a professor that I took at Harvard. His name is Charlie Nesson. He's a leading thinker on evidence, and I took a class of his on fair trial. And the text that we're going to study today, which is the Judgment of Solomon, Mishpat Shlomo, that was really central to one of the classes that he gave in that seminar. And it really opened up the way that I think about this, because even with all my background in Tanakh, I hadn't, you know, there's 929 chapters, I think there are, in Tanakh, popularized by the 929 Project. And you study things, but sometimes the Mishpat Shlomo was something I studied once in grade six, and then I studied it again for Chidon, and that was about it. And I never thought about it in the deep way that I was probed to think about it in law school and really radically rethink it. And so that piqued my curiosity, and I ended up writing a paper about it and doing some research, and this is the fruit of that synthesis. So let us jump right in, and I think you have the source sheets available to you, so I will refer to them as we go through. So part one is the introduction.
Just if I may, it's probably a good idea. Most people like it. You don't have to the whole time, but at least bits and pieces, you want to share your screen, even though they're on the chat box. I think a lot of people like to see it. They can correct me if I'm wrong, but I know. So I know some people don't like to speak as you are. So you can go back and forth. You don't have that the whole time, but if I may make that recommendation.
Okay, let's do this. I'm not so adept that I've done in the past share, don't share, but let's try that. And if not, then you may get a glimpse at some of my notes here, which I think is okay as well. Okay, so the introduction to Shlomo's judgment. Let us read this, and for the sake of simplicity, let us simply do it in English. So here's how the story goes. 1 Kings 3. And we'll do it in all its detail, because we're going to develop on these details further, so it's important to have them in our back pocket. Later, two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. The one woman said, "Please, my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. Then on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth. We were together. There was no one else with us in the house. Only the two of us were in the house. Then this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. She got up in the middle of the night and took my son from beside me while your servant slept. She laid him at her breast and laid her dead son at my breast. When I rose in the morning to nurse my son, I saw that he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, clearly it was not the son I had born. But the other woman said, no, the living son is mine, and the dead son is yours. The first said, no, the dead son is yours, and the living son is mine. So they argued before the king. And so you've got this back and forth. He said, well, she said, really, argument. And it's obviously a very dramatic situation. The stakes are very high. And if you read this story for the first time, then at this point you wait with bated breath to see what is the king going to say. And so here comes his famous answer. Then the king said, this one says, my son is alive, and your son is dead. While the other says, not so, your son is dead, and my son is the living one. So the king said, bring me a sword. And they brought a sword before the king. The king said, divide the living boy in two, then give half to the one and half to the other. But the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because compassion for her son burned within her, please, my lord, give her the living boy. Certainly do not kill. The other said, it shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide it. Then the king responded, give the first woman the living boy. Do not kill him. She is his mother. All Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king, because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to execute justice. Okay, so this is, of course, a famous story, a fascinating story, and the awe that the text records over sweeping Israel at the end of it, we can't help but share in that as readers. It is a story where Shlomo establishes his remarkable wisdom that becomes idiomatic of judicial wisdom generally. But now I want to ask you a simple question, a question that was posed in class, but a very powerful one, deceptively powerful. And the question is, why? What exactly is so wise about this approach? I think we all have one understanding of what it was that Solomon achieved here. We'll see that in the first approach that we look at. But as we'll see pretty quickly, that's certainly not the last word on the topic. And if we were just in the business of counting shitos, of counting opinions and making a chart and seeing who thinks what about this story, we would see that it's actually in the minority. And that'll be really interesting. And so we're going to try to unpack together what it is that made Solomon's decision so wise. So we come now to the traditional perspective on Solomon's judgment. I've chosen the Ralbag to express it. I might have chosen someone else, but just for the sake of the argument, let's have it, let's see it expressed. And this is in the middle of the Ralbag's passage on Melachim. Says the Ralbag, "Umizeh ha'inyan amar al amitas hadavar ki asher eino imo lo tachus imi zeru lishnayim." Basically, the Ralbag is picking up on the text, the line that's explicit in the text that says that the woman had compassion on him, in effect, because she was his mother. And Ralbag says that's what Shlomo HaMelech figured out. Shlomo HaMelech ex ante devised a test whose purpose was to tease out who's the real mother, because he knew, as it were, that the real mother is going to be the one who says, no, forget it. It's not worth it for me to be right. I'd rather the baby live in this tragic act of compassion with somebody else than die just so that I can win the court case, as it were, or at least come out even. I'd rather lose and have the baby live. And from this, the Ralbag generalizes what would seem to be the generalizable lesson from the traditional approach, which is in the next underlined portion here. He says, well, let's just actually read it from this sentence here. V'zo min ha-tachbulos ha-tovos shirai shi'asu osan ha-shoftim ha-yisharim v'fichok masa. This is among the wise stratagems that is appropriate for a judge to employ according to their wisdom. Ki lo yaspik lahem shi'snagu b'zeh l'fi ha-nemar l'fi. It's not enough for them, of course, just to go by what is said in front of them, the literal meaning of the words of Al-Rawi, rather, shi'amiku la'mod al-ha-emes k'dei shi'sh. Who, with the IMS, rather they have to really drill down and get to the bottom of the matter. Lo fianna marlahem with nehem govad. And he goes on. But that's basically the idea. The basic idea of the story is that Shlomo's wisdom lay in being able to get to the bottom of the matter in a case in which the evidence seemed scant and it seemed very difficult to adjudicate between the credibility of the two parties or the two parties before him. I suggested above that the text itself leads to this conclusion by highlighting the compassion of the one woman. Of course, contextually, it also fits with, and this is source four here, it also fits with the larger context, because if you remember, for those who are familiar with the story, in the larger context, in Malachim Aleph here, Perek Gimel, the story begins with Shlomo Melech and Givon. And what happens? Let's just quickly read it to get some background. The Givon nira Hashem al Shlomo b'chalom alayla. Hashem appears to Shlomo in the dream of the night. Ve'yomer Elokim sha'al ma'itin lach. Ask me whatever you want. Ve'yomer Shlomo ata asita im avdecha David avi chesed gadol, etc., etc., etc. And here's what he asks in the underlined portion. Ve'natata l'avdecha, please give your servant me lev shomea, a heart or a mind to understand. Lishpota sancha, or to hear and to judge your people. Lavin bein tov l'ra, to separate, to discern between good and bad. Because who is able to adjudicate this very great and difficult, very heavy nation? We'll see some interpreters take this in a direction different, this line in a direction different than what it might seem at first glance. But essentially what Shlomo seems to be saying is here is, look, it's very difficult to know what's right and wrong. Please give me the wisdom to know what's right and what's wrong. And it seems like this story, which follows immediately on its heels, is exemplifying the fact that that is exactly what happened, that Shlomo had this unique ability to discern the truth, tell the difference between right and wrong, and to have creative ways to accomplish it, creative ways of doing that. But in class, my professor Nessin, he basically challenged everything about this story and about this reading of the story. First of all, he asked, did Shlomo HaMelech get it right? As a matter of fact, did he identify the correct mother? And if he did get it right, how exactly do we know that he got it right? Are we sure that the supposed mercy exhibited by the one is sufficient evidence to demonstrate that she was indeed the mother? And might there be a difference between how Solomon figured it out and how we, as observers to the case, might be satisfied that he achieved the just outcome, the right outcome? And zooming out even more broadly, what does it mean to get it right? Is it possible that as a practical matter, Shlomo HaMelech picked the wrong mother, but that might still be the right judgment? Or that it might simply not matter who was the right mother, and that there might be other reasons why Shlomo's judgment is held up as the paragon of wise judgment? And so that's basically what prompted my paper. And I focused on the question of what made Shlomo's solution so wise. Or put another way, what is exactly the enduring lesson about justice that we are supposed to learn from this story? And I confess that the sources are not explicit on this, most of them. We have some very colorful sources. We don't have all too many sources that are explicit on the question of what exactly was Solomon's judgment, Solomon's wisdom, or to put it even more sharply, what is the enduring lesson that we can learn about legal wisdom, or about how to conduct a fair trial or a just trial? And so I want to look at those sources with you and read them closely and try to tease from them the ideas that may be more enduring and more generalized. And in the course of doing so, I'm going to propose as well my own ideas based on biblical interpretation. And so let's go now to our possibilities. And I want to start, this is section C, it's the bulk of the shiur, alternative perspectives on Shlomo's judgment. I want to start with something I thought which was pretty provocative that Professor Nessin himself raised. And this was quite creative as biblical interpretations go. Professor Nessin reviewed here as part of this analysis, source 5, which is a source, an unlikely source to wield in the context of this discussion. It's from Bereishis, it's actually from the Akedah. And just to get everyone up to speed, this is the binding of Yitzchak. And in that context, here's what we read. Right, Hashem famously tells Avram, go take your son on Har Moriah, and go take a knife to that son, right, in the fact, and go sacrifice that son. It's just Avram's about to go do it. Vayishlach Avram es yado, says the pasuk very dramatically. Vaykach es amachelos, he took the knife, lishchot es bnom, to kill his son. Vaykra alav malach Hashem min hashamayim. But at that moment that he was about to wield the sword, an angel of Hashem calls from heavens. Vayomer Avram, Avram, v'yomerinen. He says, Avram, Avram, says, here I am. He says, Vayomer al tishlach et chalanar. Do not lay your hand on the boy. Ve'al taslom luma. Do not do anything to him. Ki adal yadati ki yirei elokim atad. Because now I know that you are God fearing. You have not withheld your son from me, says Professor Nesson in a really interesting, to my mind, bit of intertextual exegesis. He says, look, this is a famous story in Israel. It's so famous that everyone would have known it, including the two litigants before Shlomo HaMelech. And therefore, the mother who comes along and says, yeah, cut the son, no big deal. Maybe she thinks that Shlomo HaMelech, at the end of the day, is going to say, oh no, I was only joking. Don't kill your son, just like Hashem had done years prior. That's an interesting suggestion. Take it or leave it. But the point that Professor Nesson was making with this, other than just create a biblical interpretation, which, by the way, I have not heard in my biblical studies. It took a law school to get this, so that was kind of fun. The point that he's making is that there is definitely room for gamesmanship here. We read this story on a naive read, and we think, oh, everyone's acting genuinely, saying only what they sincerely believe, and Solomon is adjudicating based on them. But people could be lying. Who says people are telling the truth? And if they are lying, well, then doesn't that throw Solomon's entire ruse into question? And indeed, it turns out that no more traditional source than the Gemara itself raises this possibility. And that brings us now to the next section here, source 6, for a really subversive read of this story. Gemara Makos, Kaf Beis Amud Beis. Says the Gemara, interpreting our key pasuk in our story, Vayana Melech Vayomar. The king answered, the king declared, the king testified, however you want to translate, Vayan, the king got up and said, this is King Shlomo, of course, Shnu la esayel rachai, give her the live child, Vehames lo tumisud, and do not kill him. Ki or not ki, ki imo. Says the Gemara, Minayada, how exactly did Shlomo know that she's the mother? Dilma iruma miyama. Maybe she's pulling a trick. Maybe she's playing on everyone's expectations. Maybe she's making this whole big courtroom scene and producing these crocodile tears and saying, no, don't kill the son. Not because it's her son, because she knows that everyone's going to come and say, oh, a person who would say, don't kill the son, that must be the real mother. And she's just playing them all. The Gemara is so bothered by this possibility that it injects the following addition to the narrative. Rather, says the Gemara, Shlomo HaMelech didn't know. The Gemara says, Shlomo HaMelech did not know. Instead, Yatsas Bas Kol V'amra, a Bas Kol, a heavenly voice came out and said, he no. It's his mother. The way the Gemara reads this story, Shlomo HaMelech says the words, give it to her. But he doesn't say himo. He doesn't say it's his mom. He doesn't know. He has no idea. It's God who comes along and says, that's right. She's the mother. And this is an interesting read. It's an interesting read for two reasons. It's interesting for the reason that we came to it with, that it highlights the fact that there is this problem in the text, that you have the possibility of gamesmanship, and we shouldn't be so naive as to think that it was clear or it was certain by any means that Shlomo HaMelech had the quote-unquote right answer as a matter of fact. But it's interesting for a second reason, if you think about it. And that is that at the end of the day, this story is held up as our tradition's example par excellence of what it means to exercise judicial wisdom. And if you read the story such that Shlomo HaMelech all along never really knew the answer, rather, he had to rely on God coming out of the woodwork, as it were, coming out of the machine, sorry, it's a reference to Greek idea, coming out of the machine to save the day, then what was so wise about Shlomo's judicial approach here? And what I want to suggest to you is that perhaps on the Gemara's read, the Alpha and Omega, the starting point of judicial wisdom, is the simple recognition of human fallibility. Is the idea that here I am and resolving or purporting to resolve questions of life and death, of family and of love, and I have no idea what I'm doing. How dare I pass judgment with the stakes this high? And if you have that recognition, then what will you do? Well, you won't be hasty. You won't rush to pronounce judgment. In fact, you'll take a moment to think, to reflect, to be silent, to hold your tongue before you dare do anything. And you will more broadly do everything you can to limit the scope of your pronouncements because you understand what an awesome past lies before you. And that indeed is exactly what Shlomo did. And it was in that act, as imagined by the Gemara, that willingness and ability to take a step back and say, you know what? I have no clue if I'm being honest. I could try my best. I could play probability, but I really don't know. It was in that willingness to be pensive, self-reflective, and to think, to say, as Socrates famously said, I know what I don't know. Perhaps if we are fortunate, in that space can come insight and inspiration. But the starting point has to be a recognition of our fallibility. And that is the apex of, perhaps, of human wisdom. And it's an entirely, the read is a completely opposite of how we traditionally read Shlomo's judgment. It's, on this reading, Shlomo's judgment, and there are other ways to read this far, but I'm teasing out this one idea. On this read, as I'm reading, as I'm arguing, is one way to read this tomorrow. What makes Shlomo judgment so wise is precisely the fact that he realizes that he's actually not that wise after. So that's one suggestion. There are some bits of legal theory that I have in the back of my interspersed throughout this year, but I also want to make sure we get through the rabbinic text. So I will save the best ones, and there's others that I'm just noting, so I have something here, so if at the end someone wants to ask me about it or I'll remember, I'll throw it in. But for now, let's proceed, and let's proceed to source three, and this is a fun one for me because this is something that I pieced together of my own accord. This is drawing on the Chidon of Tanakh background I alluded to, and I think that this approach will actually, in a way, provide a counterbalance to the previous approach. Because if under the previous approach, if under approach, I'm labeling the two here, right? Traditional with number one, two, and recognizing human fallibility. If under approach two, what we're saying is that, look, a judge got to realize you're basically an erroneous being. You're prone to error, so you better tread with real caution. Source three provides a counter voice in saying, yeah, we make mistakes, that's right. But we also have the ability to learn from those. And we also have the ability to course correct. And in particular, I'd like to suggest to you that the wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech in this story may be just that, that he didn't come to this case as a case of first impression, but rather there was precedent for this case, and it was a wrongly decided case. And Shlomo HaMelech saw that and applied the lessons in that case to get the right judgment in this case. So that's pretty cryptic. So what am I referring to? So this is a much less known case. It's in the middle of Shmuel Beis, Perek Yudtes. And the background here is the famous rebellion of Avshalom. Avshalom being the son of David HaMelech. Avshalom stages this rebellion. And now, basically, the parties have to align themselves into their various factions. They're going to be pro-Avshalom or pro-David HaMelech. And David HaMelech flees from his son. And Mephibosheth, who is the lame, his handicapped son of Shaul, who was taken in by David HaMelech, he doesn't come. He doesn't come with David. He stays in the palace. This is all background, and then we'll get into the case. And essentially, Siva, okay, so you have David HaMelech running away from his son of Shaul, Shaul's chasing David HaMelech runs away, and Mephibosheth stays home. Mephibosheth has a servant whose name is Siva. Siva runs to David HaMelech and says, David, you know why Mephibosheth didn't come with you? Because he betrayed you. Because he supports Avshalom. And David HaMelech says, okay, Well, in that case, I hereby award all of Nefi Gosher's property to you, Tzibah. Our case comes at the end of the rebellion. Avshalom's rebellion is put down. David and Malach is returning in safety. And now Nefi Gosher comes to tell his side of the story. And here's that story. Mephibosheth ben Shaul, we're here in source 7, Yarad Likas HaMelech, he went down to see the king, Velo Asa Raglav, Velo Asa Sfamo, Evesko Dav, Velo Kibes, Min Hayom, Lechas HaMelech, Ad Hayom Asher Barah, Ab Shalom. Basically, Mephibosheth, he didn't shave, he didn't bathe, he was in mourning the entire time that Shaul HaMelech, that David HaMelech was away. Vayi Kivav Yerushalayim, Likas HaMelech, Vayomer Lo HaMelech, Lama Lo Alachti, Mephibosheth, David HaMelech sees Mephibosheth, Mephibosheth, what's going on? Why didn't you come to me? Why didn't you come with me? Why didn't you join me? Mephibosheth says, Vayomer Adani HaMelech, he says, my master the king, Avdi Rimani, my slave, my servant, Tziva, he tricked me. Ki Amar Avdecha, I said, he said, I wanted to come. I wanted to follow. I wanted to saddle my donkey and join you. But I'm lame. I can't come with you because I can't walk. And this is an interesting play on words. Vayragel be'avdecha. Vayragel, just a side point, right? Vayragel means to like to say lashon hara, right? To gossip. But of course, it's a play on words because Tziva had legs. That worked. Moshe did not. Vayragel be'avdecha. He gossiped about me. El Adami HaMelech, to you, the king. The Adami HaMelech kemalacha Elokim, and my master, the king, is like an angel of God. Ve'aseh atov be'necha. Do what is right in your eyes. He lo ayako be'savikim manshe paves. Okay, we don't have to read this. So Pasuk basically says, listen, you've already done me a whole big favor. I can't ask for any more, David HaMelech. I'm telling you what's true, but you got to do what's right in your eyes. So then David HaMelech, in source in Pasuk Lamed, he issues his decree, his verdict. Vayomer lo HaMelech, and the Melech's King David said, Lama tedaber od varecha, don't speak anymore. Amarti ata v'tziva tachloku es hasadeh. You and Tziva can split the field. Vayomer Mephibosheth el HaMelech, Mephibosheth says to the king, Gamis akol yikach, he could have it. Let him have the whole thing. Acharei asher ba adoni hamelech shalom aleiso. As far as I'm concerned, the king came home in peace. That's enough for me. Let him keep it. If you just take a step back and think about the parallels between this story and our story, they're obvious. First of all, you've got a king. The one king is David. The other king is his son Shlomo. They're adjudicating this difficult case between these two civilians. Both civilians lay claim to the same units. Right, one is obviously more important than the other. One's a child, and one's property. Fundamentally, it's a claim. We both say that it's entirely ours, and the other one is mine. It's very difficult to adjudicate as between them. Their credibility, both of them seem credible. The circumstantial evidence perhaps is there to support both. There isn't much evidence, generally speaking. And the king comes along, and the king says, okay, we'll split it in half. The only difference, oh, and of course, another main similarity is that in the end, the party to whom it rightfully belongs references some higher value for which they're willing to cede the property or the baby, right? The mother says, I'd rather the baby live, even if it means I lose out on this. And the brother says, look, there's peace here. The king's in peace. We finally have peace. I don't want to start another. I'm injecting my interpretation here. He's saying that the king has peace. We've got peace. Let's not start other fights. That's fine. I don't want to get into splitting in and whatever. That's okay. He can have it. The difference, of course, is that as far as we can tell, this is the end of the story here in Shmuel Beis. David HaMelech lets the verdict stand. And he's criticized for it in the Gemara. Here's how the Gemara says, Gemara Yuma, Kaf Beis. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. B'shasha Amar lo David l'Mephibosheth. At the time that David said to Mephibosheth, Amarti atav etziva tachlok esasada, you two should split the field. Yatza baskol, here's that same motif, by the way, the baskol, same baskol that we saw in the Gemara's reading of the Shlomo story. So you see that the parallels are working here on multiple levels of canonicity. But what did the baskol say at that moment, says the Gemara? Rechavam ve'yeravam yachlok esamachos. That's the case in David HaMelech. If you're so laissez-faire about how you are so quick to say, okay, split it, then we'll split your kingdom too. Then we'll split your kingdom too. And sure enough, that's in fact what happened. And so David HaMelech got it wrong. He got it wrong. He didn't learn. He made a judgment, but then new information came. Then Mephibosheth came along and said, fine, you can have it. He didn't course correct. And Shlomo Melech takes a different path. He course corrects both intergenerationally and in the context of that trial. He course corrects intergenerationally, course corrects in the context of the trial, because, as it were, because he pronounces a judgment, the woman reacts, and then he takes that reaction into account and says, okay, in light of that, we need to change the verdict. Of course, it could be that this was all ex ante and he decided that. The point is that, you know, at a broad level, the motions he's going through is he's saying, okay, I'm responding to new information that's coming in front of me. What I said in the past doesn't need to be the final word. I'm willing to course correct. And of course, more poignantly, intergenerationally, he's course correcting because his father set down a certain precedent and he's learning from that precedent and realizing, oh gosh, if someone comes along after you say split it in half and they say, no, 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 it's okay, give it to the other person, maybe you better think about why they're doing that and you better probe that and you better learn. And if that's the case, if this is the right way to read, or if this is an appropriate context to adduce in our attempt to understand Shlomo's story, then it emerges that what Shlomo HaNaan did in his story is not so much issue a novel ruling as much as issue a wise overruling. That he was willing to look at the errors of the past, the judicial tradition, his own father, and say, okay, we've made mistakes. Let's learn from those mistakes and let's move past them. And that may be another hallmark of judicial wisdom. On this reading, the hallmark of Shlomo's wisdom is, again, not that he devised the strategy out of nowhere, but that he had learned from what his father did and he improved it on. Okay, four. Now this is going to be a lot of fun because it turns out that there are a whole bunch of commentators in that tradition who argue, in effect, that Shlomo Melech got it right. He did identify the correct mother. But these commentators pull this interesting exegetical move where they say he got it right, but not for the reason you think. It actually has nothing to do with the sword trick. The sword trick was kind of like a sideshow. And they propose all these reasons why Shlomo Melech actually knew who the right mother was before he even issued the trial balloon, as it were, of the sword trick. And so just to take a representative sampling here, here's a Barbanel. A Barbanel in source 10, and we'll just read the underlined portion here. The Barbanel. Shlomo hisig amitas hadavar hazeh chodin hanisayon v'abachin hazeh. He figured this out before anything even, before he even employed that test. Why? Let's actually read this part. Ki mehakaras pnei hanashim hazonos, from recognizing the faces of these women, mipartu fehen, kishiyen bahen, the open divran, he looked at their faces, he looked at the way they were speaking, kishishamausan, when he listened to them, kisig mitzpunei libosan, ve'arad la emes tanya. From just listening to the way they spoke and looking at their faces and their gestures, he was able to tell who was right and who was wrong. We'll pause there. We'll come back to the rest of the Barbanel. Now, that's source number one. Barbanel suggests really Shlomo Melech was able to tell just by looking. Yosef Kara says source number two. Source number nine, two in this section, says something different. He picks up on, you may remember from above, the woman said, "Vayhi bayom ha'shlishi lelaydasi v'tehi gamisha zos." She said the other mother gave birth 3 days later, and that's not a fact that's in dispute. Well, hold on a second. There is a big difference between a baby who was born today and a baby who was born 3 days from now. As the father of a newborn, 6-month-old, I can tell you that is true. You can tell the difference. Now, I don't know if you can tell the difference to the extent that Rav Yosef Kara is drawing upon it here. But he says, Shetinek ben yomo adayin lo napol dam bo damo. He says, their blood hasn't circulated, whatever that means, biologically, we don't have to speculate on that, but this is just interesting for legal theory underlying it. Kulach harum, blah blah blah. Metino grand shoshak par damoni blah. Okay, fine. He has this whole biological theory. The point is, from Rav Yosef Kara says, you could just look at the babies and tell. Don't look at the mothers. Forget the mothers. Look at the babies. Does this look like a 1-year-old baby? Or does it look like a 3-year-old baby? And Shlomo Melech looked at any dog. Okay, he solved the problem. And then there's the Malbim. Right, again and again. So for Yosef Kara, just like for the Rebbe. Now, this was all figured out before the Sotrik. And for the Malbim also, says the Malbim, Atomer Eishah Cheres, he picks up on how the other woman said, Lo kni ki bincha hachai uvincha hames. The Zosomer is Lo ki bincha hames uvincha hachai. Says the Malbim, Sipir kasuv ki bidvaram, Amar hani bes, hani bas lo shon bni hachai uvincha hames. Vatovas, Amar abehefe, bincha hames uvincha hachai. He says, basically, one woman is saying, my kid's the living one, and your kid's the dead one. And one mother is saying the opposite order. Your kid's the dead one, and my kid's the living one. He says, the klal lashon sha'adam yachtim tami mashu ha'ikar v'yachad esatat. He says, generally speaking, when people speak, they start with what matters most to them, and they move from there. Well, the fize has farned no penis, he says, and based on this, it's reasonable to say she'aisha she'dikdekal lahakdin loshonah b'niachai kodem. The woman who went out of her way to say my son is the living one first, ikar magmasah she'yeb chai b'no. Her main focus was my son's alive. But magdemes loshonah bincha ames, akar magmasah she'ames ben chaverta. She wasn't so much interested as my son's living. She didn't care about her son. The point is, your son dead. Reading between the lines here, he's saying if I'm going to be miserable, you're going to be miserable too. I want your son to be dead. Just like mine is. Lo shiach machai b'na. And yizek par hayayach l'havin l'achriya n'ina. So the Malbim is able to figure out based on that. Take these or leave these. But the question that jumps out at us, I think, from all of these, and this is where we do, I think, the deeper analysis is, okay, so Shlomo Melech knew before he pulled out the sword. For whatever reason he knew. Well, then the obvious question is, so then why pull out the sword? Why not say, in front of everyone, I know that this is the right baby because it's red, its blood is redder. I know that this is the right baby because this mother said, your son is living, my son is living, and your son is dead. I know that this is the right baby because I can see it in the face. Why not say that? Why do this whole shtick with the sword? I think that Barbanel, in that part that we skipped, might offer us a path towards an approach. So let's go back now to that of Barbanel and read this underlying portion. He says, "Ha'omnam asab kinahahi for him. He did this test. I'm highlighting it here on the screen. He did this test for them. Sheharoim ba'yoshvim, haroim ha'yoshvim rishona, the malchus lefanav. That those who are attending the trial, the kibur chokmaso yisamsu alehem barav exeroso, so that they could appreciate the wisdom. Ve'edu shehios emishpat utzaka." And would realize, understand, internalize that he is in fact executing justice. Barbanel doesn't say it quite as explicitly as I would like to say it, but what I would suggest, building off of this of Barbanel, is that it's one thing to get it right. It's another thing to convince others. What's for us here is that a trial doesn't exist in isolation. Trial is not just an event between the parties to the dispute. It is society's problem more generally. There is rupture in our society. And we want the onlookers, just as much as the litigants, to believe that there is justice here. And so, yeah, you could say this blood's redder, that blood's not as red. People might not be as convinced by that. I don't know if you're as convinced by it. I'm not sure. I wouldn't have the opportunity if I was there to see the baby. You're not going to bring the baby in front of me. And maybe you buy this idea, or maybe you don't, that whoever preceded the other, that the language you used to precede, that the language you start with is the main idea. That maybe you buy it, maybe you don't. Shlomo HaMelech on the Barbanel reading had to do something that would convince everybody, that would leave them emotionally satisfied that justice has been done. And on this reading, again, to our larger question, what is so wise about Solomon's solution? What's so wise about his solution is he realizes I might be some ivory tower genius who could figure these things out in 2 seconds. But that's not enough. I've got to make sure that the people whose lives are being impacted by justice, not just the litigants, again, but society more broadly, feel that justice has been done. And so I need to convince them. I cannot just rule by fiat. I have to do something that makes them walk home feeling a sense of peace and the justice has been executed. And that is the enduring lesson, perhaps, on this reading or putting some pieces together of Shlomo's judgment. I'll pause here just to say that there is a line of legal theory that says that, I'll tell you sort of the main approach and then how it connects to this. So there's an approach that says that Shlomo HaMelech didn't necessarily know who was the right mother. He wasn't interested in that. But Shlomo HaMelech really wanted to know what's the best interest of the child, which of course is an important standard even until today in family disputes. And so when Shlomo HaMelech said, let's cut the baby in half, and he saw that one woman was on, let's cut the baby in half, that didn't prove to him that it was a mother, but it proved to him that this was the right woman to be responsible for this child. And that's a pretty common interpretation in legal theory. Now, what's interesting about it for our purposes is that my professor, Professor Nesson, and some others, Murray and Green, have written the piece where they say, so why didn't Shlomo just say that? Why didn't he just tell them, okay, she's the right one to be the baby? He said, because no one would have accepted that in whatever year this was in ancient Israel. It was not an accepted idea that you would say, let's do what's in the best. And that's what they argue. I don't know if they're, I'm not here to adjudicate whether or not they're right on the biblical interpretation, but their point is that they make the fascinating and controversial claim that Shlomo HaMelech's wisdom on this reading was not only in exercising discretion, but in obfuscating the very fact that he was doing that. So whereas I'm saying that if you read the Rabbi Ravanel a certain way in these sources, what's so wise about what Shlomo is doing is that he communicated his reasoning. He took the effort to convince people that he was right. What they're saying is that he obfuscated his reasoning, that he didn't want them to know what he was really doing, because he didn't think they could handle it, or that they would accept it, or that it was even in line with the legal traditions to which he was supposed to be beholden. And therefore, he got the outcome that he thought was right, but he did it by playing within the rules that he was banned through. Anyway, that's a really interesting and subversive read, and it obviously has political valence, but it's pretty interesting, and I just want to put it out there and give you that tidbit. What's interesting more broadly, again, about source four, and with this we transition, section four, and with this we transition into the later sections, is that, again, this is highlighting for us that a trial, again, is not just an event, or even perhaps primarily an event between the two litigants, but rather it's an event that affects society broadly. And what we're going to see as we move forward, I'm going to argue, is that you have a line of interpretation that views the wisdom of Solomon as somehow not being bound to the particulars of the trial per se, as much as the way in which what he did had implications for society, for larger society generally. And so with that, we go to source four, and here's the Radak. And the Radak says in source four, Lasot Mishpat, Lasot Mishpat, Lefichach, says the Radak, Yirumi Panav, Lasot Devara, he says, as a result of Shlomo's judgment, people moving forward would be afraid. They'd be afraid to do anything wrong. Va'afilu b'seiser, even in the privacy of their own home, doesn't get much more private than this house between these two single women. And you might think that you could pull a fast one and you could switch a baby. Says Ladak, what you learn from Saul, from Shlomo's judgment, what he taught all of me as well, is you're not going to get away with it. You're not going to get away with it. Why? Ki ra'u, for they saw. Ki berov tochmaso, in his great wisdom, he will have the power to do what? Yotzid la'or mishpat, to bring truth to light. As was done in this case. It's a subtle point, but it's an interesting emphasis. The Radak here is not quite saying or not quite emphasizing the fact that Shlomo got it in. He's emphasizing the effect of that fact upon the onlookers. He is saying, look, what was so great about Shlomo's judgment was the impact it had on larger society, in that it taught them you're not going to get away with it. Shlomo will have one way or another to figure it out. And by the way, what's interesting as a side point here, of course, is that this interpretation, I think, works whether or not Shlomo actually got it right. It doesn't really matter if Shlomo got it right, does it? What really matters is that you believe Shlomo got it right. Because if you believe Shlomo got it right, then you're not going to try to pull some stunt like you think this woman tried to pull, because you think that Shlomo HaMelech, or the judicial system more broadly, is going to catch you. And so what the Radak is emphasizing here is a concept that comes up a lot in the law, which is the concept of deterrence. That part of the law as written and the law as adjudicated and the law as enforced is not just about the case before us, but how do we prevent lawlessness generally? And Shlomo, in his wisdom, found a way, says the Radak, to adjudicate the case in a way that would be so famous and so memorable and so internalized in people's hearts that they would say, my God, I better not try anything because I'm going to get caught. Source 13. Rabbi Yosef Kar, we saw him above. I want to quote something else from him because I think we could take it in a bit of a different direction. I think it's also interesting for us. Here, Rabbi Yosef Kar is not talking, is not interpreting the story per se. He's interpreting that prelude passage that we saw for Shlomo Daven's wisdom. And here's how Rabbi Yosef Kar reads that line that I flagged momentarily above. Says Rabbi Yosef Kar, "V'zeu adavar v'nasata la v'chalei shomea." When he asks for a lei shomea, when Shlomo Melech says, "Please give me a heart that understands, or a mind that understands or hears," what was he saying? Pisrano, the way to interpret it, to understand it, leiv mevin lishbar samchal la'vin bein tov l'ra, to have the ability to judge between good and bad. Kimi yuchal lishbar samchal kaved hazeh, kim adam sheyesh bo chokhma yaseira. Only someone with great wisdom can adjudicate this nation. Now this is what he says. She'am rav yashlo asakim yaseirim uba'im ladin. Why is it so hard to adjudicate these people? Not because they're particularly smart or because they're particularly complex, or not to say that they're not, but what he's emphasizing here is something different. There's so many of them. There are so many lawsuits. And I can't possibly, I don't have the time, I don't have the ability to go through every single lawsuit. This guy's yelling, and before I even have time to listen to this guy, Yenim's coming, his friend, and screaming at me also. What am I supposed to do? Everyone's yelling. I don't have time to adjudicate all these lawsuits. So why do I need wisdom? Not necessarily because in a particular case I need to figure things out, but rather, let's read on. How am I supposed to adjudicate 1,000 lawsuits in one day? If I'm not really smart. What is Rabbi Yosef Kar emphasizing here? What he's emphasizing, I think, is not that Shlomo Melech got it right, but that he got it right efficiently. Could Shlomo Melech have done more to make sure that he was right? He probably could have sent messengers to go gather evidence and could have tried to get witnesses. I mean, there's all sorts of things. Maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. But on this reading, I think what's so wise, what Rabbi Yosef Kar is emphasizing, is that again, it's a systemic approach. It's not about this one lawsuit. It's about the fact that there is an entire society that needs justice. And what he's emphasizing is you got to make sure that justice doesn't get prolonged. The case comes in, you do what you need to do, you figure it out, and then you move on because there are a million other people that are waiting to have justice executed for them. And so what was so wise about what Shlomo Melech did on this reading, I think, is that he did it efficiently. He found a way to cut through, pun intended, all the red tape and all the procedure, and you don't need to go, you don't need to get in 15 witnesses and subpoena people and do production and all the stages of civil procedure that we're familiar with. You run a test, and if you're smart enough, you'll be able to figure it out, and then you can move on. And so what Rabbi Yosef Kar is here is emphasizing is that one hallmark of judicial wisdom is the wisdom to realize that we can't have scorched earth approaches. We can't leave every stone unturned, because if we do, well, yeah, we'll do a great job in one case and leave 999 off in the distance. Now, I do want to make one point that actually just occurred to me in the context of this year, so I'm kind of excited about it. That line that Shlomo Melech says, "Mi yuchal lishbor esam pa'al kaved hazeh," to me, that has resonance, as I think, from the story where Yitro comes to Moshe, and Yitro says, these people are standing before you from morning to evening, and they're so heavy. You have to go back and look at the way it's phrased there, and then there's resonances that in Ta'alos. So again, a parallel story. Maybe Rabbi Yosef Kar is, I'm not sure, but maybe that is text is in mind for him there, because Yitro famously says to Moshe, look, you have to be efficient about this. You cannot have people standing in front of you all day long. Maybe Rabbi Yosef Kar is hearing in Shlomo Melech's words echoes of that story, and therefore importing that line of interpretation. I'm not sure. That's just a breaking thought. But be that as it may, there's an idea that justice has to be administrable for efficiency purposes. And I think between the lines, that's what Rabbi Yitzchak is suggesting is one of the hallmarks of Shlomo Klippa. Okay, source six is all fun. Source six is fun. Section six again. Section six is fun at the beginning in part because it kind of represents the Talmudic codification of these sorts of disputes. So you have this sort of paradigmatic dispute in the story of Shlomo and in Malachim, but then of course these cases or versions of these cases, if you will, take on more abstract form in the Talmud, where you have two people and they're arguing, and you know, Shnayim Ofsim and Talis would be an example. Two people are holding up the Talis, and this one says it's mine, and this one says it's his, and they're arguing, and now the question is, what do you do? And so here's one particular example of it. It's more complex than the most simple case, but just happens to be the locus for this conversation textually. So let's just look at it. Shnayim shifkidu etzel echad. The Gemara, the Mishnah talks about a case where two people deposit money with someone. Zemanev zemasayim. This one left 100. This another left 200. They didn't remember who deposited 100 and who deposited 200. Zeomer, or the guy didn't. Zeomer shalima, the custodian. Zeomer shalima sign. The Zeomer shalima sign. This guy says 200. This guy says 200. Both are basically saying, I'm the one who deposited 200, right? Similar structure to our story, which no one knows. Says the Tanakama, nosim lozemana, the lozemana. So each one gets 100, because we know they each deposited at least 100. And the rest you should leave aside until Eliyahu Navi comes. Basically, we don't know what to do. We set it aside. And we don't know. Eliyahu Navi maybe will come and figure things out for us, but until then we don't know. And then Rabbi Yossi has this interesting line. It's interesting, not really critical for our purposes, but we'll just read it. I'm a Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says, In Ken Mahitsi Ramai. What exactly, where's the deterrence, right? We just talked about deterrence above. Says Rabbi Yossi, where's the deterrence? If you give each one 100, then the guy who really only was only owed 100, who gets 200, who was claiming 200, what does he lose out? Right? Again, think about it. One guy left 100. One guy left 200. They both claim like 100. At the end of the day, they both get 100. So the guy who really gave 100 from the beginning, he was going to get 100 either way. He didn't lose out. So he didn't lose anything from the fact that he claimed 200. He claimed 200. He got 100. He only was over 100. So Shalom Al-Yisrael, from his perspective. So he has no disincentive not to lie. No disincentive to lie. There's double negative there. No disincentive to lie. So rather, says Rabbi Yossi, El Hakol Yehim Nachat Shevoya. Put it all to the side. No one gets anything. And that way, hopefully, what Rabbi Yossi, basically Rabbi Yossi is employing a version of Shlomo Malach's logic here, if I can say so. What he's essentially saying is, let them all lose out, and hopefully the guy who is it's kind of backwards. It's kind of backwards, right? Hopefully the liar will come forth, because at that point, wouldn't be able to gain any more from that. Anyways. What's interesting about this is the tshuva of the Russians. Because here's what the Rush says. Kol dina, says the Rush. Any judgment. The lo efshar livurei. There, it's not possible to, how do you want to translate that? How to figure it out 100%, let's say. To really verify it. Lo amrin an yehem yinachat shevoya. We shouldn't say, okay, throw up our hands in the air. Throw our hands up in the air and say, we don't know. Let's just leave it to the side and let Eliyahu Navi figure it out. Says the Rosh, we shouldn't do that. Yadun hadayin l'fi masha'in ha'bros. You must judge based off of the information in front of you. Omed dasa v'sfar mu'etes shmir alo. You have to use whatever reasoning you have and whatever possible rationale you can have to reach a conclusion here based off the information in front of you. Becham rabbi b'na'a l'madin zeh me'ava chachami b'masa sheba l'fanav. Says the Rosh, this principle is learned out from no less the greatest of all wise ones. In the story of the two women who came with him with the baby. And he goes on and he describes the story. But for the Rosh, here's what the takeaway is from that story. The Hainu Taima, says the Rosh, once a judgment, once a lawsuit has come before the judge, and he's not able to know with 100% accuracy, and the Rosh is following tradition that he doesn't know with 100% accuracy because he's quoting that Gemara above that says that the gospel came out. You're not allowed to literally, I mean, he's almost saying the expression in a parallel idiom in Hebrew here. You're not allowed to throw your hands up in the air. You're not allowed to say, I don't know. Because then what's going to happen? V'yarivu, ha'balei din, saying that. They're going to keep fighting. V'chsiv, and that is in contradiction to what is written in the pasuk, emes u'mishpat shalom. Truth and judgment are peace. Ki al yedei ha'mishpat yashalom ba'olam. Says the Rosh, the purpose of judgment is to bring peace to the world. To the world. There is a rupture in our society. We cannot accept that. And there are values that are more important than absolute truth. And that is that two people came before us with a fight. They better go home with a resolution. Doesn't mean they're going to be friends. Doesn't mean they're going to be best friends. But it does mean that we as a society can feel that there is a resolution to our conflict, that they don't just simmer up, that we have a way of putting it behind us. Says the Rosh, L'chach masnu koach l'dayan nishpot v'lasos mashiyotze. Therefore, the judge has the power, and I would say the discretion, to do what he wants, af v'lo tam v'raya, even though he has no reason and no proof. You have to see what the Rosh really means, no reason or no proof, but that's the words he's using here, very strong formulation. Kidei l'seis shalom ba'olam, in order that there should be peace in the world. An amazing thing, this Rosh. This Rosh is telling us that at the end of the day, it almost doesn't. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. What matters is that, of course, you don't want to be arbitrary then, but you do your best. And having attempted to do your best, you don't think twice or worry about it because you've got to make peace in the world. That's your fundamental role as a judge. And if we throw up our hands too often, people will say, well, what's the point of going to court? And then you're going to get in a situation of called the Alan Gar. Everyone's just going to not go to court, just going to fight it out amongst themselves. There's going to be lawlessness in the streets. We can't have that. So we have to have some system of adjudicating disputes, as imperfect as it is, because that is what allows our society to stay together. And that is the wisdom of Shlomo Melech, the wisdom to realize, look, I don't know for sure. But one thing I'm not going to do is let these women go home without a resolution, with everyone watching. Because then we start to lose faith in the ability to put our fight behind us. Not in our faith to get it right, but to put our fight behind us. We have to have some mechanism of putting our fight behind us. Okay, we're almost at the hour here. Let's just do one more. Rav Chaim Angel has this interesting idea. He has it in the Jewish Bible Quarterly. And let's just read it. I mean, he put it in English. I can't say his idea better than he can. Let's read it. Says Rav Chaim Angel, but another element in the narrative has not yet been addressed. The aforementioned interpreters all focus on a conflict between two women. None considers significant the fact that the litigants are prostitutes. During his prophetic encounter with God, that's that prayer we saw, right? Where Shlomo asked for wisdom. Shlomo is always referred by his name four times and never as king. When rendering judgment to the prostitutes is a really incisive observation by Rav Angel. He always is referred to as the king 10 times and never as Solomon. Part of the reason behind this appellationship is to show that before God, all people are equal and nobody else may be called king. In the episode with the prostitutes, it is specifically Solomon fulfilling the important role of kingship, rendering justice in a difficult case. And then he makes his broader point. Prostitution is a lowly occupation in any society. The tenfold repetition of the term the king in contrast to these prostitutes then is striking. It appears that a primary message of this narrative is that anyone could gain an audience with Solomon and receive a fair hearing. And then he makes his broader point about what biblical wisdom means on this reading. Biblical wisdom does not refer only to having a high IQ or superior problem-solving abilities. It includes the ability to judge with fairness and to live righteously in accordance with the principle of wisdom. We'll just skip to the next underlying portion. That prostitutes could gain an audience with Solomon and that he would listen so attentively to their arguments that he could solve their case with no witnesses demonstrates Solomon's true wisdom. We can connect this to the idea above that part of Solomon's wisdom is expanding access to justice. Prostitutes don't get their day in court if you're spending endless amount of judicial resources judging the quote-unquote big cases. Solomon's wisdom is the wisdom to say everyone deserves their day in court, and I'm going to have the wisdom, as we saw earlier, to not waste resources frivolously so that everyone gets their day, and then to say everyone is important enough that they get their dating court. And according to Rav Chaim Angel, that is the enduring wisdom of Shlomo Melech. Okay, we'll stop here because it's 2:31 and I promised 2:30. But I hope that you've enjoyed this. We've done a sweep of some really interesting and divergent theories on what the enduring lesson of Shlomo's wisdom may have been, and I believe now is the question period. So I'll go to the chat and see what has been written. Okay, let's see here. Jade, okay, so we have a question. Among other things, what is the definition of a true mother? Interesting. I suppose you could parse that out. I think in this context, it's not so controversial. The true mother would, of course, be the mother who gave birth to the son. Now, I don't know when the question was asked, but as we develop later in this year, right, it could be that the best mother is not the true mother, by which I mean the biological mother. And indeed, a lot of legal academia read this story as suggesting that maybe the quote-unquote true mother or the biological mother is not as important as who's going to be best for the child. Another person asked, Frieda Finkelstein, do we know which is the real mother, number one or two? That's interesting. You know, again, the text certainly strongly implies that Shlomo and Melech got it right. But it doesn't say that explicitly. So I have seen people make a deal out of that and say, yeah, we don't know for sure. Interesting. Frieda Finkelstein says David HaMelech, in that case, of Nebuchadnezzar, made his ruling without hearing both sides. Well, in a sense, in other words, Siva did come to him. So he made his initial ruling without hearing Mephibosheth. And then, yes, he later, when Mephibosheth came, we don't see that he heard Siva. So he kind of made two half rulings, which is interesting. You would think that it would be important. In fact, we have halacha. You know, you don't listen without a baal din present. So yeah, that's a good point. And then I think someone else is pointing out, in contrast, that Shlomo Melech not only listened to each other, but repeated back to them what he had heard, which of course is important emotionally, just to validate somebody. Any psychologist will tell you the number one thing you do is validate someone you without repeating them, but try to show them you understand. If you say to them what you heard from them. So that's a great point on Shlomo's emotional intelligence. Someone asked, what is the significance of telling us that they were harlots? Yes, yeah, so I think the Prime Angel addresses that. There are other suggestions, but the Prime Angel, I think, has a really nice take on that. That was the last thing we saw.
Yeah, I think that's what you said was a pretty magnanimous approach to, you know, anybody deserves their day in court. I, after practicing criminal and dependency law for 35 years, have a different approach, a different take on this. I think that mentioning that they're prostitutes, harlots, is to let us know that we shouldn't really believe everything they say. These are women who chose a dishonest profession, and who knows, maybe Solomon was a John.
Interesting. So one, if we are going to challenge the traditional interpretation and suggest that maybe they got it wrong, one piece of character evidence that you might have used to that end would be, well, look at their profession. They're not in a profession, it's fundamentally honest. So why would you take this prima facie view that they're telling the truth? Very interesting.
Something else occurred to me. It's been a very long time since I've looked at this text. And as you were reading it, I was thinking, you know, it's a newborn and a three-day-old. We think of three-day-olds as newborns, but they're not. And they don't look alike. And that I don't know if Shlomo HaMelech would actually have experience to recognize a newborn from a three-day-old. But if perhaps he did, then, or suspected that this one looks like it's younger than the other one, he then used the other test, like, to test himself as a, like, another proof. You know, the one that he said, this is the mother, you know, she's the one who's not going to let the baby die. That he, you know, it's sort of like a 1-2 punch. It's like, I think this is the one, let me see if I can prove it another way.
Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, that's a good point about evidence generally. Very rarely, if ever, do you have a silver bullet in evidence. You know, what you're doing is piecing together a bunch of evidence to try to make a larger, to try to draw a conclusion. And maybe what Shlomo Melech, maybe another way, in other words, of reading those three sources that we collected that suggest that Shlomo Melech knew the answer beforehand is that he thought he knew the answer beforehand, but he was wise enough to check his work, you know, to have multiple ways of trying to arrive at the same answer.
Right.
But the second woman never agrees necessarily with the story of the first woman, that the baby was 3 days old and so forth.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, I elided over that. I suggested that this is a fact that is not in dispute, simply deriving that from the lacuna of any counter chatter on this point. But you're right. Maybe she disagreed. We don't know for sure. Maybe she didn't dispute it because she didn't see how it could be significant. Right? That's the danger here also, is that, you know, they may not know which facts are legally significant. And so why waste my capital arguing a point that I don't think is significant, and then turns out it's central to the case? And even more problematic, of course, is that according to, I forgot who it was who said that this was the central feature in the case, I think it was Yosef Carr, they never find out that it mattered. They never find out. So that's, you know, that could be problematic, because maybe they would have disputed it had they known.
There's another reason that their being zonot plays a role in the case, and that is that it's an explanation of the fact that there are no witnesses. There's no family members present. I mean, if they had been a typical married woman, then even if they were sharing an apartment, there would have been other family members present at the birth and the subsequent days, who could have identified the baby, who would have seen what happened. So it makes it a convincing case that there's no evidence.
That's right. That's very good. Yes, yes. That is a commonly raised comment on this story. And you know, it also justifies why Shlomo HaMelech may not have sought further evidence. We may feel different about his decision not to adduce further evidence if he had reason to believe that there was such evidence possibly extant. Let me see if there's anything else here. What about people who can see? Jail for years after having been wrongly convicted. What do you mean by that? That's an interesting comment. And it came at 228, so I'm trying to reverse engineer when that might have come in, but I'm not sure what prompted it.
All right. Well, I think a general comment, you know, doing something wrong. If you got the wrong person, if you got the wrong mother, you know, it's like somebody convicted for murder and is found out 25 years later to be innocent. It's a pretty terrible, terrible situation. I assume I can't speak for other people, but anyway. Okay, and then somebody just wants asking for your paper. How can they can get a copy?
Sure. Yes, I'm happy to send it. I will put my email here, so I can be emailed and also Rabbi Kalman in case it doesn't come through.
I mean, if you want, I normally don't give out our speakers' emails, but if you agree and people email me for it, I'm happy to send it to you. But you just did, so
that's yes, fine. Please. I'm more than happy to be in contact with anyone who'd like.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. We'll let you go over time and be well and enjoy. I think you get a mazel tov. I think he's on paternity leave, if I'm not mistaken. Correct?
So, yes.
Okay. Very nice. And tonight, Dr. Sokolow continues his series on how Tanakh was put together. Tomorrow, Shuli Mishkan finishes up her series on medieval Israel. And then tomorrow night's Parsha Shir is given by Leah Silver. And then my Shir on the Siddur, 9 o'clock Friday morning. We'll continuing with Alan Nisim and continue on Hanukkah stuff from the Siddur for these 2 weeks. Okay, we look forward to seeing you all soon. Invite a friend and everybody be well. And Chanukah Sameach. And thank you, Rabbi Magid. All the best. Thank you.